And I started working with Marco when he came to visit me in London. And Silvio had written sort of fantastic comments about Marco. I remember when Marco first got to London, we were sort of talking with each other for about 3 weeks, and I concluded that he was an idiot. I concluded that I couldn't communicate with him at all. And then after, suddenly there was a phase transition. And it's not like I decided that Marco was one of my favorite scientists. And actually, he has really amazed me with his creativity and ability to get things done the way that he thinks about things. So he's going to be talking about complex systems, and so I'm not going to try to say anything about what he's actually talking about. I just wanted to say a couple of things about some other things that Marco has worked on that he's not going to talk about. So his early work was on field theoretic aspects of polymer physics, which I actually couldn't really tell you very much about. Later, this included testing a lot of theories that Fontier had developed for polymers. Later, he worked on DNA and RNA denaturization transitions and in relation to pseudo-knots. He's also made models of getting complex networks using Hamiltonian dynamics, which is a very interesting problem. And one thing which I really know very little about was a paper that he wrote on mutually avoiding random walks in two-dimensional quantum gravity, which is also something that I know nothing about. But he's not going to talk about any of those things here, so if you're interested in those things, then you can talk to him afterwards about those works and related issues. He's actually here today and tomorrow.
Thank you very much for the introduction. So now I have also an excuse if you don't understand anything today. It's before the phase transition. So the subject today is complex correlations in self-organized critical phenomena. So the first step is to say what I mean by the critical phenomenon, by complex correlations. And then I will describe the particular cases, which are earthquakes and solar flares. I will describe these cases because they are the two I have been studying with my faculty. And finally, there is a new stage, which is a new development recently I made in KU University in Berlin. And it's related to a model of self-organized criticality, which is a concept supposed to describe this critical phenomenon. And I will describe the troubles we have recently with models of self-organized criticality to mimic the real aspects of these complex systems. And finally, I'll give you the conclusions, which are basically my personal recipe of approaching this this field. So, by self-organized critical phenomena, I mean a system which is out of equilibrium, and it's slowly loaded by an external drive. And then due to some nonlinear local interaction within the units of the system, can be that locally one reaches some instability, which eventually is transmitted to some neighbors of the unstable unit, and in this way can create an avalanche of the system.
Sorry, what is slowly loaded?
Well, the system is out of equilibrium, so you, according to the nature of the system, you add some stress locally. Let's suppose you have a fault, for example, in the roof. So you load until a minimum threshold is taken, you have a slip in the fault. So this is maybe one of the best examples I can make of self-organized. And then what you have in the end is that this slow loading is transformed into a signal which has a lot of spikes of avalanches, let's say, in which a global interaction can take place and emerges by the nonlinear local rules. And in this way, the slow loading is transformed into a fast relaxation of the system. Examples could be solar flares, earthquakes, forest fires, landslides, some tiles falling where the grain falls, for example, things like that. And so One important point in this kind of systems is that we have scale-free statistics of the size of these allowances. So you can have allowances ranging over many orders of magnitude without problems. For example, in earthquakes, again, like this example, you can have something like a truck moving, going to this very big earthquake, so if you have example, for example. Another aspect, not really, let's say, yet clean, is the correlation between these allowances. I mean, in real systems, you observe correlations like earthquakes, they are clustered in space and time, as I'm going to show. But in the models, not so clear whether we have this kind of correlation. So there is an ongoing debate on whether the models are suitable to describe the real systems. In particular, in real systems like the dynamics of the Earth crust, there are complex correlations not only between allowances and time, but also in space. And all these variables, like space, time, and size of the allowances, or earthquakes, or whatever you want to call them, are involved usually in a global picture in which all of them are important. So this is what I mean by complex correlations. So let's start with the earthquakes. This is a plot of Gutenberg-Ritter distribution of earthquakes, where you see the number of earthquakes during the last 20 years in Southern California as a function of the magnitude. So magnitude is related to the energy released by the Earth during the earthquake in this way. In any case, what is basic in this is that this is a power law distribution as a function of the energy released. So you don't have any particular scale relevant for the problem. And what is going on, for example, in this region of the scale distribution is qualitatively similar to what is going on the other side. So this is why usually one calls this system critical, because you have that in equilibrium system as a critical phase transition, you have this kind of power law correlations between quantities. Another aspect of earthquakes is this distribution of extempers in space. This is again Southern California, and you see that they found this cluster. Clusters which have a non-trivial structure in space. In particular, they are distributed according to a fractal distribution. But in any case, you see a non-trivial geometry that appears in this case. However, what you don't see in this case is how big is the magnitude of a given point in the graph and when it appears. So what we can plot, let's say, in these graphs are kind of sections of the phenomenon. For example, you can see the phenomenon in space or in time or time and magnitude, etc. For example, another aspect of seismicity is the Omori law, which in this case, indeed, you take a slice in time and you see the magnitude of the events. And you can see that after a big event like the biggest one in Southern California during the last 20 years, you have a lot of activity immediately after the strong earthquake. This is called the Omori law and simply describes the rate of events after this main shock, which is scaling like an hyperbolic function. This is a symptom of the, it says this very clearly, the clustering in time of seismicity, for example. So, in order to understand this complex correlation in space-time and intensity of the events, so far people usually did an approach in which you take a space-time window after you identify a main event. So you have something very big, you say that's the main event. And you see that all these events following the main shock within a given distance are called aftershocks. So there is a kind of classification of events. You study the properties of these events, you can do this, etc. But this doesn't capture the full complexity of earthquakes, because you never know whether this window you go in space and time is able to capture all the events that are going to be defined as aftershocks. If it is maybe too long or too short, etc. And a second more subtle problem is that once you define a main event, you are going to define everything after that as an after shock. This doesn't display any of the evident hierarchy in the phenomenon of earthquakes. In particular, it can be that what is called a main shock is followed by a strong aftershock, which in turn is followed by other aftershocks. And in that case, it couldn't be clear how to say whether the second aftershock is an aftershock of the main event or the first aftershock.
This is a recent result by Bakker and co-workers, and also followed by a work by Borel,
in which they showed indeed that there is a very complex phenomenology involving the time after events, the intensity, and the size of the window in space you take. And what you measure as the distribution of working times is not simply a function of the number of events you have, but you have to include all these variables in order to understand seismicity. In particular, you see it that once you collapse the data, they fall all on the same scaling function, which means that there is a kind of self-similar character of seismicity, again, saying us that you don't have any particular distinction between main events and aftershocks. And that using finite space type windows, you don't fully capture the nature of this system.
Excuse me. Yes. Exponent small b, is it universal?
That's usually close to one, and the total distribution measured close to one. That's a point where there is no agreement. Say there is people thinking that it is one. Some people thinking that it has many different values according to the Earth area.
Those papers were just fitted as a three parameter to be fitted, yes? In the scaling behavior you have shown.
Yeah. But indeed, in this case, they take just a single B you can fit during the last 10 years in Southern California. And also, you measure the sample dimension, yeah. In this way, you are able to fit data. Of course, you can also tune a little bit the numbers in order to have a better worst scale. So, related to the problem of defining aftershocks, this is a very trivial example in which for a while I forget that there is space, so I just focus the attention of the time series of earthquakes. And the problem is to decide whether this event is an aftershock of the first one or of the second one. You see, the first one has a bigger magnitude, so it's likely to be the one originating all the seismicity later. But an approach could be the following. You look backward in time from this event, and you check whether there are events particularly unusual. By unusual, I mean that during the time windows in between them and the last one, the probability of occurrence of this event is very small. So in this sketch, I computed without any constant, etc., just to make an example, that the first one should occur six times of times the main state during that time interval, which is a very small number. So it's unlikely that this couple of events is created by chance. You have to be correlations in order to observe in practice such a couple of events. On the other hand, also this couple of events is not so unlikely to take place at random, because in this sketch it has 10 to the minus 7 on the probability. In any case, comparing these two numbers, you could say that one is more unusual and it's likely to be the one generating the next. But for example, if the last event is very close in time to the last but one, you observe that now the probability that this is taking place is smaller with respect to the probability that the other one is taking place during a longer time window. This is smaller even if the Gutenberg-Richter factor involved in this formula is bigger.
Can you explain why that's a good model for a correlation? Why is the unlikelihood of event in the time when you go networks relevant to the
what
effects of the cause of what you're looking at?
In this case, we are just computing the number of events which we expect during a given time window and with a given magnitude. So let's say this is the Gutenberg factor, which is accounting for the magnitude. And this is the time window with which we are waiting to, in order to see, well, that's defined by a certain feature. So during, let's say, 1.2 hours, we expect to find the, well, was 1 hour, okay, so I think it's wrong, but it's still bigger. We expect to find something like 6 to 10 times 10 to the -8 events. So that's the number of events with magnitude 7.3 we expect during 1 hour.
I understand the calculations, I just don't understand the interaction. I don't understand why, sorry, why you don't get rid of these numbers tells you which event, which the prior events is likely to be associated.
But in this way, by computing all these quantities with all previous events, you are computing the probability that they take place, the number of events that you will expect during that time window. Okay, maybe I should go directly to the global argument, which is measure correlation between events by means of an instrument. Of how much the null hypothesis that the earthquakes are correlated is really. So we just first suppose that the earthquakes are uncorrelated, and we check that this is violated in practice. The couple of events that mostly violate this hypothesis is the one mostly correlated. Does it make sense?
Maybe I'll catch up.
Okay. So in particular, fully taking into account space, time, and magnitude, we can say that in a volume around the magnitude m, in an interval delta m, and during in an area of size l, and during a time t, the number of events m that we expect is given by some constant time. The Gutenberg factor, which says events with more magnitudes are more likely to take place, times the area we are considering, which according to the magnitude of the threshold, times the time interval we have been waiting collecting events, let's say. So one can see that each pair of events I and j can give us a number nij, which is this number we have here. This nij is used by us as a metric, in the sense that nij is the number of events we expect in a region separated by events I and j, by the time interval between event I and event j, and with the magnitude of the first event. So if this nij is very small, it means that let's say 10 to the minus 8, as we had before. If this is very small, it means that 10 to the minus 8 events with these features should have happened during that time, space, and with that magnitude, which is very unlikely to take place. It's an event with a small probability, but it took place in practice. So this means that it took place due to some correlation. It couldn't take place at random.
Well, doesn't that statement depend on the size of your sample? I mean, if you have 10 to the 8 Earths on which there are 10 to the 10 earthquakes, then for sure you will find something like that even if they're not correlated.
Well, it could be that, let's say there is an earthquake here and an earthquake almost simultaneously on the other side of the Earth. But the size of these catalogs is such that you don't have any such a phenomenon. Let's say in Southern California, it's very unlikely that you have uncorrelated events at the same time. So what you observe is, okay, this is a statistical analysis. It can be that sometimes you find something that is almost simultaneous, but without correlation. In general.
Do you correct for that? Do you correct for that?
No, but the numbers we require, let's say the number of events we require is 10 to the minus 4, which is already a very small number during this space-time region. So if we declare a pair of events as being correlated, if the number of events of the first kind as 10 to the minus 4, probably first place is quite an unlikely event to take place at random.
Well, you also have the rate C, right? That's correct.
Yeah, of course, when we tune this number here, we first measure this C, which is related to the seismicity rate during the last 20 years in California. So it's also shifting everything to a very demanding region, which if you require even correlation, it's a very unlikely event to take place downward.
The technical question is metric M to be symmetric related to IJ. So in the experiment, you have only MI, not MI minus MJ.
Why do you want it to be symmetric? You have a
process. It's kind of the distance between I and J events I and J.
Yes, okay. In this, strictly speaking, a metric probably should be symmetric,
yes.
But maybe we are using this word in a loose sense.
No, it's not symmetric.
No.
It's not really a metric. It assigns a number to a pair of events, but that number is not some sort of a distance between two events. It's how likely are those two events to be random.
Yeah.
So
okay. We use the word metric in the sense of something giving us a quantity to estimate. It's the more practical, let's say, use of the word. It's not a mathematical word. So. Very small NIJ means very high correlation. So if you take the inverse of that CIJ, you expect that a big CIJ is giving a lot of correlation. So the distribution of this CIJ is a power law over many orders of magnitude. It became like C to the minus 1.5. So this says that the process of seismicity has a huge range of correlations. And in particular, it's not very clear by looking at only at this one whether you should say that something here can bigger and the bigger correlation is correlated, and something from here to smaller correlation is not correlated. So you know, it's at this stage, it's also subjective to decide whether something is correlated or not. But it says us at least that this huge variation of correlations allow us to decide that the links that we are going to draw from between correlated events makes sense. I mean that can happen that in the past you have events with this small high correlation and a lot of events with a small correlation. So the few ones with high correlation are the ones that you want to link. In this way you achieve a huge simplification of the problem, because in principle every event will be correlated to all the other events. In practice, if you cut the whole bulk of this distribution and you took only events for the correlation between events that are bigger than a given number here, the number of relevant correlation you will end up are a very small number compared to the reasonable. And the extreme case is just draw a link from the past event, which is mostly correlated to the one. Okay, so we did this and we observed that this N star, which is the extreme, the best, the most correlated past event, has also a scale free distribution with an exponent minus 1. So we have also arguments to say that at this stage where there are not many variations, if we change the time span of the couple, the distribution is robust, and so we claim that correlations are a robust feature of seismicity in this range, while in this case here we just discard the pair of events as being correlated. So what we are going to do is to create a network of earthquakes by linking events which are correlated. So the nodes of the network will be the events, the earthquakes, and the links will be the noting correlations. What it turns out that is that you have an hierarchical structure of seismicity in which there are main shocks, which in turn give rise to other shocks, which again in turn give rise to main shocks. So in this case, this A is land event. You see on this side, you created this first aftershock, which in turn created this second one, which was bigger than this first aftershock. And then indeed, you see a cloud of third generation of aftershocks. But again, this is everything this approach is given automatically. You don't decide in advance what is a main shock and what is an after shock. This scale-free character is indeed also evident in this distribution of the number of links you are going out from an event. It's a scale-free distribution with an exponent minus 2. And so this links us also with a recent flow of scale-free networks, which is increasingly giving results on internet or on other systems, like, for example, the cells inside our body. They are able to create networks of interaction between chemical constituents of the cells. So now I'm going to describe the phenomenology we observe more related to the geophysical, let's say, approach to earthquakes. In particular, what I showed at the beginning, which is the Mori law, stating that the rate of events after an earthquake is decaying at 1 over t function, where t is the time, is valid to, let's say, to orders of magnitude. I mean, if you take events with magnitude 3, you observe a Mori law after them. If you take events with magnitude 4, you still see the same Mori law. If you take events with magnitude 5 again, and if you take the biggest one, which is Mendes, after some time, while you have problems collecting data, you have also the Mori law holding in quite long time span. And this is a new result. I mean, in literature, you know that the Mori law is holding for earthquakes, but it's the first time it is apparent also for small events. So again, this is saying us that there is not a clear distinction between what they call main shocks and what are the rest of this. A new phenomenology, completely new, we find is that the distribution of aftershocks, aftershock distances, is also scale-free. As you see from this space, in this log-log scale. But we find also that there is a relevant length scale with the magnitude of the event emitting the aftershocks. So if you find event as a magnitude, let's say, in the range from 2.5 to 3.4, there's this distribution here, the black one. While if you have a big event, it's likely that he has aftershocks in this region, up to there, and then it decays. But again, this is part of a wall scale tissue in which you have the magnitude and the distance are related to each other. You cannot separate the two variables. Indeed, by scaling the distance of aftershocks by this type of length, you can collapse the distribution to a single scaling function. Which is again a signature of complex correlations, which has to be explained and also which has to be included in models of seismicity in order to fully mimic seismicity by models. If you relax the constraint of taking only one emitting node, one incoming node to one incoming link to a new node, you also observe cluttering within the network. Cluttering basically means that you form triangles of linked nodes. And if you measure the cluttering coefficient, which is saying us how much, roughly speaking, how much is cluttered seismicity, you observe again some new phenomenology, which wasn't new up to now, in which you see this asymptote here points to a cluttering coefficient open tail, while for high degree of the node, which is for high number of outgoing links, we have a decay of this clustering according to another universal. And this is very robust because you can change the threshold of the correlation you ask for, and you still observe the same features. Okay, well, now there is a section about prediction of earthquakes, which is another subject that has been studied, but I guess I'm running a little bit late, so if you're interested at the end of the talk, I can describe it. So, summarizing, the new point in this approach is that by defining a metric, you can create a network of earthquakes and you can quantify correlations between earthquakes. What you obtain is a feature in which space, time, and magnitude of events are related to each other. And you see also that all the new things appear. But all of them, they not a scale-free character of this network. And OK, something I've not shown in detail is that these results are quite stable to variations of the parameters. For example, if you take a different fractal dimension or a different b-value, you're taking the same results in the end. Another system, which is, according to my interpretation, a system with critical phenomena, are solar flares, in which you have the X-ray emissions, which in this case have been recorded by ghosts of lights, and which are this blue signal here. You may see, in this case, okay, first you see the 11 years periodicity inside the sun. But then, along this average behavior, you see also spikes coming out, which are what usually are called solar flares. But if you look in detail at the signal, for example, during a week, you see that it's not so clear what is a solar flare and what is an event, and what is not a solar flare in particular. And now let's take this big object here. Is it a single event or just a sum of smaller events? So the normal definition usually is to take some local increase of the signal, which is significant, and then to stop it as longer up when there is another spike, let's say. We tried different approach in which the thresholds are an important ingredient. By threshold, I mean that you take a minimum intensity, and everything about that intensity is a problem. And then it's quite simple to define an event in this case. Just take a threshold equal to 2.10⁻⁶, for example. And you define an event as something beginning above the threshold and ending at the end of the threshold. So we don't care of the form of the signal, but just apply this simple definition of events. In particular, according to the old definition, probably these two peaks could have been defined as two different events. But in the old, let's say, approach, nobody never tried, let's say, a full analysis in which the thresholds are varied. So this also, in this case, there is a new ingredient, which is trying to vary the threshold and see what happens to the statistics. Statistics, in particular, in this case, of the waiting times between the events. OK, well. First, one can check what happens to the duration of the events, which is the size and time of these objects. And this is again scale-free, needless to say. But it has a global form which follows this function here. And this exponent gamma is quite stable from the minimum of the solar cycle to the maximum. So it's a quite robust feature of the flares. Instead, if you look at the waiting times or the quiet times between the events, which maybe I should show you, the quiet times are the periods in which you don't have any activity above the threshold, while the waiting times are the sum basically of quiet and duration of events. In principle, you should expect different statistics, but it turns out that the duration is much shorter than the average waiting time, quite much. So if you compare the waiting times distributions between events at different thresholds and the quiet time distribution of different thresholds, they are more or less the same. Secondly, when you increase the threshold, let's say going from 10 to the minus 6 watts per square meter to 10 to the minus 4, which is more or less this range, you see that the waiting time distribution is changing. There's still a tail, a tiny number, a power tail, but slowly it has developing a region in which it's flatter. So according, let's say, to a standard approach, this could be described as different power loss. Let's say you take the tail and you see that increasing the threshold is becoming less steeper. So this exponent 2.1, where you have the smallest threshold, is, could be interpreted as a different exponent in this region. The same happens if you take smaller couples around the minimum of the solar cycle to the maximum of the solar cycle. Again, you observe that at the beginning you have a power of A, which is becoming less and less steeper. However, we found a different explanation of this behavior by scaling the times by the rates of the events above a given intensity. So in this case, you see that again there is a relation between the time and the intensity of the events, which cannot be divided into different categories and studied separately. What you see is that by scaling the data in this way, it collapses. It collapses onto a single scaling function, which is varying during the cycle of the sun, but the scaling picture is valid everywhere. In particular, one can do also the same scaling analysis for the flares. The flares are defined according to the standard definition. One finds basically the same results, which means that our simple definition of event captures the nature of the system as the standard more complex definition of the system of the flares.
What happens if you change the overall length of time over which you can measure this? I mean, so if you just cut the time in half, you use 1 year or you use 2 years?
The point is that there is this 11 years periodicity here. So if you stay at the minimum, which you identify as the region where you have the smallest fit, you observe that kind of distribution with a given flow. If you stay at the maximum, you observe different statistics. If you stay in between, it's not so clear what you observe because the cooldown states it's rather subjective because you don't know which kind of threshold you can put. For example, at the maximum you put thresholds in this range, in the minimum in this range, but then if you take the full thing, what you have at the minimum is not taken into account basically because the statistics is dominated by the maximum of the. Here you have a lot of activity compared to here, so if you take.
Suppose you just say in the neighborhood of the maximum. And you used only 1 month or another plot between you.
Well, already in this case, by taking the full couple, we don't have a huge statistics. So
you don't have enough statistics for time.
If you take it even shorter, it's not so clear whether you can. I guess you interpolate in any case between these statistics and the one of the mean. These are the distributions of the maximum, and these are the mean. And if you compare them to the global ones, they are on the two sides, let's say this set of smaller exponent and this set of bigger exponent. So the global statistics is a kind of average of the two ones.
No, I'm not worried about the periodicity. I'm just wondering if you get any dependence on the size of the window that you use. If you sit, say, near the maximum, then you're saying there's not enough statistics to answer that.
Well, of course, if you put a smaller size, you have also a cutoff here in the power law because it's extending up to the maximum of the. That's affecting what you could expect. But apart from this, I don't see anything because here you see you have a very long catalog and you don't see the cutoff. So it means that you don't have enough statistics to see the cutoff due to. The couple. If you integrate over main solar cycles, probably you would have seen something. But in any case, there is this 11 years periodicity starting as an analysis. You could also try to make statistics over time intervals which are shorter, but then of course it will depend on the place in which you take.
Maybe I could just one more. I mean, suppose the sun didn't have this periodicity, suppose it was always at a maximum. What would you expect to see if you made the time longer and longer? Would you always expect to see the same curve extended, or would you see
no,
a systematic change in the curve?
What? I can't say, but in the case of earthquakes, for example, the time span is important because when you increase it, you observe a difference. Let's say the cutoff is changing, but the bulk of the distribution is the same. in the Arctic case, I guess also in this case, you should have been prospective. But I don't know which kind of fine size effect you should have by this. This is the point of criticality. You have scale 3 behavior up to a fine size at all, which is due to the observed time in the cell or due to the size of the sample in space, etc. So this scaling, rescaling of course, onto the same function again is fitted by this function here, in which you see the gamma exponent is varying with the phase of this cycle. But it is in quite good agreement with what also other researchers have determined by just fitting the tail of the distribution and with the usual definition of stars. So, possible description in terms of Poissonian waiting time distribution with a varying rate is possible. In this case, this probability of waiting times with between events with the intensity greater than I is described as an average of the waiting times you have different rates. And you derive this formula in which you have this x of minus lambda tau, lambda t, in which you have the Poisson, let's say, waiting time distribution. But then by integrating it over a wide range of rates, you obtain a scale 3 distribution of waiting times. In particular, you obtain the distribution I showed you, this one, this one over one plus x over x star of the gamma. So you, by fitting in that case with this function, you can also argue that the distribution of rates is changing from this f max, the maximum of the cycle, to this f min of the minimum. Turns out that this distribution of rates of the minimum is related to it's the same as the one you expect in a subcritical branching process. In this case, the units branching are the units of rate, in some sense. And when you have a branching process which is subcritical, you find this distribution in the end. So the summary about flares is that, again, there are complex correlations relating intensity and the time. And in case you can include both variables into a single scaling function. And we have seen also that the definition of flare for events according to our simple definition is not so crucial. So now the final part of the talk is about possibility of mimicking these properties of complex systems by simple models. The particular model is inspired by the concept of self-organized criticality, which was proposed by Backstein and Wilson in 1987, and then had a big success during the last 20 years. Well, the most famous example of self-organized critical system is the SunPy, in which you drop the link and let's say in a given site, in a given lattice for a given site, and you continue slowly, drop the range at random in a given point up to a stage in which locally there is an instability, which in this case would be okay, let's take a boundary condition like this. You have made some file like this. If you again add a gradient here in this position, it can be that you cross a critical threshold in which you define the some file to be unstable. So in this case, you can choose to model the fall of grains by this kind of toppings in which you take an amount of grains and you put them to the lowest level. But then in turn, it could be that this new unit is again unstable due to this updating. And again, you take it and you move it to the next stage. In this way, you create analogs, what is usually called analogs. And usually, the models of self-programmed criticality are open, have open boundary conditions in which you have a grain that in the end can fall outside of the system somewhere. and they are slowly driven at random, which means that you take a grain and you put it, you choose one of the sites from 1 to 12 at random, and you put the grain in that position. So quite striking that with these simple models, in the end, you obtain a distribution of sizes which is scale-free. So the message, the main message is that even with such a simple model, you can obtain the most important feature of this critical phenomenon, which is the scale-free distribution of fallacies. And so this is why it attracted a lot of attention in the last 20 years. An aspect instead which didn't attract that much attention is the correlation between the allowances. In particular, what you obtain in the end is that if you define time as measured by the number of grains you put, so when you are at time 8, it means that you add 8 grains. What you observe as a signal is something like some activity, something, some other activities, and then eventually a huge relaxation, which we supposed to take place immediately. So we take a complete separation between the time scales of an avalanche and the time scale of the slow driving inside the avalanche. In this way, you obtain a signal which has this scale-free distribution of avalanches, but usually what you see is that the intercurrence time, what was called before TW, the waiting times between events, has a Poissonian distribution. So this is a shortcoming of the standard models of circularness criticality, because they don't include these complex correlations between events. I mean in general, but in particular, there have been many attempts to find a time correlation between quantities inside the same bias. In particular, at the beginning, the focus was on the supposed one over F noise, which is the form of power spectrum. If you just take the Fourier transform of the signal and you square it, and this is called power spectrum. And when you plot it in log-log scale, you see that this power spectrum usually has a power law behavior. And in most natural phenomena, you observe that it has a 1 over F scaling, which is very far from being trivial. Instead, in simpler examples, you could have 1 over F squared, which is less difficult to obtain. So many attempts were made to find this 1 over F behavior, also feature also in subgraph critical models. But turned out that in many cases, when you have 1 over F, you don't have any more criticality. So you have to pay for that. So that the distribution of avalanches is not anymore scale free, but becomes bounded while you achieve 1 over F. But again, when in this model here, at least when you want the criticality, you lose the correlation sometimes, which is a little bit disappointing. In case, there are also other models in which you look at a global quantity, like the average slope of the sandbar. By slope, I mean this angle here, or at the global force according to the model that you are considering. And in this case, indeed, you can still preserve criticality, but you have also correlations in time between the elements. In particular, in these two models, I can also note that they are given at one boundary, which means, for example, put the grains only in this position. This is an extremely deterministic way of deciding the driving, which is the other, let's say, on the other side of putting the grain at random. And so this may suggest that the place where you put the grains is relevant for obtaining correlations in time. Other models in which you have correlations in time are the so-called running sampires, in which you don't wait for a full relaxation of the sampire, but with a given rate you continue to put grains inside it. And so in this case, again, the use of thresholds is relevant, is important, because What you have is basically a signal in which you have a lot of background activity and then some emerging phenomena. And if you don't remove this background, you still observe Poissonians, the trivial Poissonian working time distribution. Otherwise, once you have increased the threshold, you could start to see some statistics of waiting times, which is not trivial, and which has some power law decay. In case a message, this people census human address is stressing that the memory is stored in the configuration of the sampai, it's just stored inside the configuration. If you wait without overlapping the avalanches, the memory of the past, which is the only thing that can give one of the noise, can be retrieved by the configuration. So again, this is another aspect that suggested to me that in order to have an effective retrieval of the memory, you should also do something more specific in space, not only put the send at random. There is another model suggesting this, which is this Volani Feather Christensen model, which is a model of a single fault in which you have strings connected by the fault. Okay, units representing strings connecting blocks. And in this model, indeed, you observe what we saw before, indeed, the Mori law, and also some correlations between the dissenters. So, in my opinion, it's not by chance that once you see correlations in the place where you put grains, and also when you see correlations in time, it's not by chance that these two aspects take place together. In any case, this model is a coupled lattice model. It's not a sampai in which you, by a procedure decided by you, decide where to put the grains, but it's indeed the dynamics of the system that decides where to put the grains. And it can be another relevant aspect to be considered for models that have to mimic real situations. So finally, there is another class of things in which you put a correlated driving inside the sampai and you obtain a correlated output. So, correlated, I mean intensity. So, you put a lot of sand and you see a lot of output. That's basically what we see. Which maybe is not what we want because okay, it's not so exciting that you put something correlated inside and you obtain something correlated inside. Okay. So, the models I used basically have these situations. Either they are completely random, driven at random, so you choose one place at random where to put the grain and you see what happens. Or they are completely deterministic in the sense that you drive always on the same point. Or they are drive at random but with correlations intensity. So the main lines to be followed at this stage are to insist in trying to show that these classical models of self-organized criticality are correlations in time, or try a new route, let's say, which is the one I am trying currently, and which is to put some correlations in space artificially at this stage, and to see whether this can induce correlations in time. Put correlations in space is not something unnatural, because indeed in natural systems there are correlations in space. And also, it doesn't mean that driving correlated in space necessarily creates a complex output. I mean, the present stage is given by this example, which you drive the sampai by a random walk. So, what's taking place is this. You take a periodic boundary condition, so this one is linked to this one. And then you have a configuration of the sampai. And the position in which you put the new grain is moving as around the wall. So if this is high and you put a grain in this position at time t, at time t plus 1, you are going to put a grain either here or here. Okay? And you choose that at random. Again, the relaxation procedure is the same. If you put a grain and it is unstable, you fall down and you topple, you put the grain of that, and eventually this creates an avalanche of grains falling down. So, very simple model, but nevertheless, if you compute the power spectrum, you observe one RF spectrum. Still having criticality. I didn't show you, but you have again the power law distribution of balances. So it seems that it makes sense to go in this direction. In particular, you can do the same in two dimensions. Again, with the same relaxation procedure, which is take a grain, put it somewhere, and if some neighbor has a difference in height, which is too big, you transfer grains to that neighbor. This can take place in parallel to several neighbors, if in both directions or three directions or four, you have this kind of instability. So let's say you put a grain here, it can be that it creates a sliding of the wall, this wall side of this mountain created by the random walk. The random walk, which in particular in this configuration was in this position here. So what happened is that by chance, first it created this mountain here by staying a lot of time here and putting a lot of sand there. And then it moved somewhere else, starting to create something new. So it's not like in the original Sandpile models in which you just have a single slope, which is close to be critical, but you have many patches of criticality with different lengths and fluctuating. For this model two dimension, I'm showing here finally the distribution of waiting times, which is again scale free, like for solid curve, for example. And so this again confirms to me that this kind of approach can indeed be useful to use these models to describe real systems. So finally, my conclusions are kind of my personal approach to this problem, which is that to further understand this critical phenomena, one can use several tools, quantum mechanics, several ideas like the scaling analysis we did for solar flares, or use novel approaches like using metrics to measure correlations. But still, one should show that the simple models that are supposed to describe these systems have also correlations in space and time, and so a possible direction is to try to implement these correlations in the models. And so this finally is a self-oriented guide. Is here just to say that I believe that this concept is suitable to describe this world class of phenomena.
Any questions?
Yeah, it's about one of the graphs where you analyze the earthquakes. The correlation or probability as a function of distance. I was wondering if anyone, you or someone else, did a analysis where they would just distribute the So if you distribute earthquakes randomly, so when you make a model and you know random points, what kind of a curve would you get? In other words, you distribute your earthquakes randomly, and then you do the same analysis. Would you
mean you distribute randomly according to which law?
But no correlation between earthquakes.
So you mean just to create a sample in which the position and the time of course is random, and also the magnitude is random.
Pardon?
You take just points with a random magnitude, time.
Yes, but drawn from the average distribution that you have shown before. So not uniformly random, shown from a phenomenologically observed random distribution, but no correlation.
You are referring to distribution in magnitude?
In magnitude time. And space, yeah. And then time.
Well, in space you mean the fractal distribution, the cluster that I showed. Well, indeed, one approach that Maya is trying is to shuffle catalogs and to see what changes. In this case, in particular, we didn't do this because also of time reasons, because it was around 3 months in pre-altogether time to do everything. But indeed, you can get information by shuffling catalogs and see what changes.
Yeah.
I don't have any answer for your question because I don't know what changes if you change the order of the things or you don't think so.
Well, that would tell you whether if critical behavior that you observe is perhaps the generic feature of random sets or whether it's really a physical feature of earthquakes.
Yeah.
I think that's a pretty.
That's indeed a. Things like this are worth trying. Is that we should do that if possible, let's say.
It goes back to my question in earlier in your talk, whether you can account for possible effects of pure statistics in your work.
Yeah, I understand. But, you should just compare this to this random case and see whether there is a significant. That's something indeed that we should do. But we have the reasons to argue that, for example, taking a threshold yield, as you said, 10 to the minus 4, for example, was already a quite conservative value for the threshold. Because, for example, if you look at the nodes inside the biggest cluster, so let's say first you start from a single cluster without putting any threshold for putting links. You just take one link from the most correlated event to the new one. And then you continue to lower a threshold and instead put links only if they are the most correlated path and if they are below that threshold. So what you see is that first there is a big cluster, then it starts to break in smaller ones. And finally, what you obtain is a scale-free distribution of clusters, which is taking place when the fraction of nodes inside the biggest cluster is smaller than this quantity. So this is a kind of further parameter of the fraction of nodes in the biggest cluster.
But Marco, we did remember look at what happens to the PFC. Right. This thing is 15 orders of magnitude for earthquakes. If you choose everything randomly, but this is the basic thing used to construct the network, then you lose the scaling by, you would not become a broad distribution. And our kind of analysis would not really make sense. So you have to go back to the very beginning to do that. But anyhow.
Okay, but well, another indication was that this other parameter has a sharp kind of phase transition, which lower than that value here, you have a different behavior from higher. You observe also that in the scale free distribution of clusters, which is visible only below that threshold. So we can quantify also a threshold in which you start to take only correlated events, mainly correlated events. Of course, it's a statistical analysis. So.
A related question is whether you can put some kind of error bars. I mean, these are statistical quantities, right? So, do you have enough earthquakes in your sample that the error bars would be negligible in the plots?
In what we see, there are about several thousand, I think tens of thousands, I don't remember actually. There were greater than 2.5 of magnitude, so it's about 20,000 events during 20 years. Another thing one should do is take different regions in the globe, let's say, because this is statistics, this statistics is just for Southern California, so one should also make statistics for different regions in the Earth. You have also to consider that these catalogs are very good, but they started to record good catalogs not so far in time, let's say. In Southern California, they are quite good since several decades, but in other regions, they are not so. So the availability of good data is not so clear, not so.
I mean, the logarithms of the probabilities go down to very low numbers.
Here.
Yeah. So 10 to the minus.
This is because I put logarithmic beams. It's data beamed in logarithmic. Okay. This circle here is just an average of the probability of the rabin which I would exclude. So if you have one point on the rabin that is increasing in size, it gives you a number which is smaller than one over the number of data you have.
Yeah. Okay.
That's why you take
okay, but then if so, what is the typical number in your bins? I mean, if it's one, then your standard deviation is about the same, right? It's also about one.
One perhaps just for the last point, which we don't know. This is just one point, probably it's the biggest flux. Then it starts to move somewhere, but when it merges to the rest of the distribution, it means that you are obtaining a final state to distribution. As long as you have a separate point, it's an indication that you are about the transition.
Yeah. I'm confused about a very general thing. Maybe it's just a question of language, but you seem to use the words scale-free and power law as synonyms. Is that right? Scale-free means exactly the same thing as power law. Because some of these power laws, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, there are dimensional constants entering into the relationship. There may be a funny combination of dimensions, like length of energy to the two-thirds or something like that. But they're not just pure numbers. So, first, I mean, am I right about that?
If it
is right, is it really fair to call such a distribution scale-free?
Probably you are right in the sense that I should call that power law. I'm afraid that in statistical mechanics, usually we have this shortcoming of confusing these terms. But you're right, that's a power law with a scale of a small business. But the point is that the tail is a power law.
No, even in the tail. I'm not worrying about it. I mean, consider cosmology. So there are many power law factors for the primordial density fluctuations, but I think only one is truly scale free.
I don't understand how you can have a scale at the end. But if you have a scale in the power law, it's just because you have a finite size effect.
No, because it's the constant in the power law relation. There's always some constant, so, and that constant can have dimensions. It doesn't have to be a pure number.
That's just all you use.
No, it's not all you use. I mean, like the Kepler's law for planets is some sort of power law, whatever it is, it's a triangle. I mean, there's some dimensional number there, which is the mass of the sun.
Well, by scale three, I mean, if you have a power law, it's the take to time x to the minus alpha, and you go to y, which is, I don't know.
But the a can have a scale.
Yeah, but the form of the distribution is scale three. I mean, you obtain a new distribution.
Maybe I'm just confused. And if you think of cosmology, maybe someone who knows more can say something about this. But my impression is that one talks about the primordial density fluctuation. And there are many, there's a particular one called the Harrison-Zeldovich spectrum, which was proposed because it is truly scale three. And it is a power law, but it's not just any power law, it's a very particular power law. Only that choice of the exponents truly gives a scale-free distribution in the sense that you cannot, by looking at that distribution, deduce any length scale of
it.
It would be more complicated, it wouldn't be just length, it wouldn't be just any length, it would be some combination of energy and time. But there'd be a dimensional number that you could read out of the data.
The point is that you can have a physical cost in front of the power law, but if you change your units or your the nature of your quantity, you have another quantity.
But the dimensional number is changing. There's a difference between a dimensional number and a pure number. But the length is not the same thing.
Yes, but
as like k, for example, which is a pure number. It's true that the length will change not values if you change your units.
Okay, I agree, but there is something in front of the power law which can be with the scales and also the variable inside the power law, but the point is the form of the function. This is x to the minus alpha, and if you rename this y as being x again, this is again x to the minus alpha by changing the scale. Let's say y is x to the 2. So this is the point. You change the scale and you still have the same form of the function. Here, this the same one. This is why we call it scale free. It's not referring to a scale of meters or kilograms, it's a scale in terms of numbers. You just change your viewer and you have the same form of the function. If you have an exponential distribution, there is a scale, you see this x0 here. If you change the scale, the distribution changes. It's not anymore the same. I mean, if
we can just go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. Other questions? Okay, cool. Let's take one more.
Do you want to talk with the markup?
Well, I don't know if it's